This week, it's Rose Red, broadcast live from the drug testing lab at Harrison University, where the subjects of Lot 6 are about to... Ow! Watch out with the matches, Andy. Jeez. Welcome to...
The Dark Multiverse of Stephen... The Dark Multiverse of... The Dark Multiverse of...
Oh, my God. It's the Dark Multiverse of Stephen King, okay? So, basically, Rose Red was a three-part miniseries, mm-hmm. and so this episode is going to be a little bit longer than our usual ones. We apologize for that, but we hope you really enjoy yourselves because we had fun doing it. Hi, Brad.
Hi, honey. How are you?
I'm good, honey. How was your day?
Good. So we're here to talk about Rose Red. I know, and this is the first one. Yeah, this is the first one we've done that's an original screenplay, not mm-hmm. from one of the books, and it's only been made once.
I think you can't mess with perfection.
That's it. There's tons of meta story around this thing. We could talk about Rose Red without talking about Rose Red for forever. But real quickly, I just was reading, Wikipedia and other mm-hmm. highly academic journals about this that. King wrote this originally and pitched it to Steven Spielberg as a feature film, and Spielberg didn't like it.
Why?
And I don't know. And then later, he pitched it to Mick Garris, the guy that directed a bunch of other movies. Mick didn't like it.
Why didn't he go to Frank Darabont?
Don't think he knew Darabont at this point, because we're talking early 2000s. And then he talked to this guy, Craig Baxley, this director, mm-hmm. who also directed Storm of the Century and a couple of other things.
Which I love as well.
And he was working, they finally decided... that they would start working on it. He was well into the script, and that's when he got hit by the van.
King was writing this?
He was writing this. He was writing Rose Red.
And he still finished it without it getting all like wacky-do?
He looked at it as like therapy.
I thought Dreamcatcher was the therapy.
I think it was too. But this
I think
was
that was the real, that one and the one where the guy gets his arm cut off. Oh, Duma Key,
I which think. Is that was a little bit later, but right, actually one. Literally in the middle of this thing.
I think Duma Key was his way of working through the post-trauma of,
But he said literally, it hurt to actually push the pencil when he was working on this thing, but that was it was better for him than the drugs that they gave him. So
good for him, because I really like this.
Yeah, so he finished this, decided it would be better as a miniseries, and then they sold it.
I rolled my ankles last year in December, and I'm still having issues with walking, and that was just like a really terrible sprain and broken toes. I can't imagine actually coming up with something so wildly and amazingly creative, and I just love this.
And the thing is, King wanted to write a haunted house story.
He didn't feel like he'd done it.
And originally, the original pitch way back was really to kind of do his take on two classic haunted house stories that he loved, that everybody in the horror field loves. The Haunting of Hill House mm-hmm. by Shirley Jackson and The Legend of Hell House by Richard Matheson.
Wait, what about The House on Haunted Hill?
That's a movie. I'm talking about two books.
Oh, I'm sorry.
These are two books that were classics in their periods. They've also been made into movies. And there are huge elements of both of those in this deal we'll talk about as we go on. But that was his original intent, was to do that. It was 3 or 4 or 5 years before he finally got it all together and Craig Baxley made it.
When you see me hopping around on the bed and just getting super excited, I love haunted houses. I go insane for them. So we haven't spoken about it. I just casually said... Why don't we do Rose Red?
And
we
had already. The other thing that he loves is, besides those two books, is he's always been fascinated by the Winchester Mystery House. It's the true story of a woman who built a house and who believed that if she stopped building it, she would die.
Whoa.
And there's recently been a not great, not bad movie called Winchester, but it's an actual place up in Northern California. You can go visit.
I do want to go
rooms
visit.
Rooms and rooms and rooms, and she just kept adding to it
my
until
birthday's
she
leap
died.
Leap year, so every 4 years you have to do something awesome for me, and that's what I want for my next leap year birthday.
And that's what we'll do. Winchester's a real place, and that's a real story that she did. And, she stopped building, and a few years later she died. Probably would have died anyway. She's like 80-something. But anyway,
I like the idea, though.
And there are elements of that in here. Ooh. So King quite honestly admitted that he was lifting from other people's books and real life and from his own characters. Now, we'll talk about how many of these characters in here are actually lifts from his own books. That these are different versions of characters he's had a million times before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
On purpose. I mean, this whole thing to him was kind of a pastiche of all these things. And, mm-hmm.
and
he never claimed this was one
process,
of his most...
And his healing process.
Yeah. And it was one of his most original things, but he does still have a great affection for it.
Cheers.
Cheers. All right. Settle. At the risk of repeating myself endlessly, remember that this whole dang podcast, from end to end and side to side, is one huge spoiler. We just assume that you've already gone back and rewatched Rose Red, or that you remember it so well you don't need to, because we'll be talking about endings and character reveals and various deaths and destruction as if you do remember every detail, just like we don't. So if you haven't, don't blame us. We just can't help ourselves. Now, on with the show. Anyway, this thing kind of came out, got really good ratings, but it did not get great reviews. Rose Red.
Was this before the internet really, like,
you know? Yeah, if you look at, like, Rotten Tomatoes or Metacritic now, and you can see what people said, they thought it was too long, was kind of pointless. They thought it was too complicated.
What? Oh, please. How crazy.
And I think it has survived the test of time pretty well.
Okay.
And as usual, we're laying on the bed, we're watching it as we talk, so we keep getting distracted
as
people are showing up. And
jump topic, it's because people are popping up and we want to say, yeah. Oh my God, I remember this about this, and I want to talk about this.
Okay, this one's a little complicated, I know, but Rose Red is an original screenplay, well, a miniseries, written by Stephen King that premiered in January of 2002 on ABC. It had a pretty substantial budget, $35 million for a three-parter. It took the producers 5 months to find the right location, which turned out to be Thornwood Castle, a real-life estate in Lakewood, Washington, which is now a bed and breakfast and an event site. You can have your wedding there. That'd be cool. ABC did an unusual thing, too. It spent about $200,000 on promoting the miniseries, including a fake website for the fake university that's featured in the film, and the writing and publication of a fake novel, The Diary of Emily Rimbauer, which we mentioned briefly. About 18.5 million people watched Rose Red during that first broadcast. It's a genuine ratings hit. Rose Red is fondly remembered by many King fans, but it's not that easy to see again. It's not available on any of the streaming services. Netflix doesn't offer the DVD, and even Amazon isn't selling new copies, digital or DVD. You can see a badly degraded picture-in-picture version for free on YouTube, or you can get a used copy on eBay for 10 or 20 bucks, or you can employ whatever other nefarious means you may have, and we leave that to you, wink, wink, nudge, nudge. It's not like anybody's making it easy. Anyway, here's the Rose Red. Let's get back to it. So obviously, you really love this.
Okay, I love it, because I love haunted houses, and I'm obsessed with haunted places. So Rose Red is so wonderful because it's this woman who is just totally pissed off at her husband. He cheated on her when they went on their year-long honeymoon tour and gave her an STD. And she is in love with her house, and she meets her companion, her best friend, who becomes like her sister. And I just absolutely love their friendship. I love the strength of women, and I love the fact that the house is their bonding place. It also becomes, from even before it was actually built, people start dying, so it's got a high death count. That's what I like about Stephen King. It's
cursed earth, pretty much from the beginning. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, and again, all these elements of all these other classic haunted house things that are in King's head and that he cooks together on this. The fact that you've got this group of people that are going in.
Let's talk about the group.
And that some of them have been in there before and some have not, just like in Legend of Hell House. You've got a lot of the same characters with personality disorders that do that. And the whole Winchester house, the house itself keeps adding rooms and growing and changing as it goes. It's not just that it's haunted by one guy, but the house itself seems to have a malevolent personality.
Yes.
And its own.
And in the part two of it, Joyce actually starts it out talking about some houses are good and they comfort you, they protect you, they're the clothes outside of your clothes, they shelter you.
Mm-hmm.
Some houses are bad. That's what we say when we say haunted or possessed or whatever. And I thought that was a really cool little slow monologue as it just kind of goes over the house. It was beautifully done.
And I think that's part of King's whole thing. He thinks there are good houses and bad houses. He usually has haunted places, cities, villages,
or even a
thin
room.
Thin spaces
in the universe.
Hotels, but the kind of classic haunted house. Another thing you'd like to know, this originally was set in Los Angeles.
Oh.
But then they found the house that they were going to use for the interiors and exteriors in Seattle. So he rewrote it to set it in Seattle.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah.
That would explain the lighting, the natural lighting of the day. There's no like bright sunlight. Everything seems filtered, you know,
I think
as it would if it's kind of overcast.
I think it's beautifully directed.
It's very
and
gorgeous.
And lit. It would be such a temptation to go all gothic and weird And it doesn't. It's a big, interesting house, but it's not automatically a spooky house.
No, it's not. It's a beautiful house. The thing is that's so cool about Rose Red is that she's a paranormal psychologist, Nancy Travis. The character Joyce. I'll just call her Joyce.
Yeah, call her Joyce. Yeah. Yeah.
Dr. Joyce.
I'll talk about Nancy a little bit later.
Dr. Joyce knows about Rose Red. It continues to build, even though no one has been in it. It would build a room here, build a room there. Some days you go in, it's 78 rooms. Other days you go in, it's 88 or 90, you know, something. And I think that that's so terrifying and wonderful. And the fact that, like, I want to see those rooms, but the fact that you could disappear and that Rose Red treats women differently than it does men. If you're a woman, you disappear. The implication by the end is that you help build. It's a girls' club, basically. Yeah. And then the guys, they all get killed. Well, I mean, she says, damn all men in her diary, which, by the way, there's
that.
You
know, I didn't even notice that, but you're right. Yeah. All the men die.
All the men die, and all the women disappear. They help build. Except for her family member, Steve, this last one, she gives him the hammer, and she wants him to help her build. Now, I don't know if he would have died had he joined, because he was a nice man, taking him into the ranks, but she thought that all men were shit. Ellen Rembauer's diary is even a movie, which I remember watching, and I remember blocking it.
Directed by Baxley. Those last
this guy?
Did. Yeah, the guy directed this directed the Diary of Emily
I didn't
Rembauer.
Like that.
And there was a book called The Diary of Emily Rembauer that was written off this. And for a while, everybody thought either Stephen King or Tabitha King had written it.
Probably Tabitha.
No, actually, it was James Patterson, the guy that went on to write.
Oh, fuck him.
Yeah,
sorry.
It was a friend of King's at the time.
Are they still friends?
I don't know. But he wrote that book that basically is the backstory of this whole thing.
I used to love Patterson when I was young. Yeah, and then I realized that every book was the same exact fucking book.
Yeah, then
book.
You started to have taste.
Anyways,
but
yeah,
he makes
correct.
A ton of movies, a ton of money as a pulp writer.
So if I really can't stand something about it offends me so much to one degree or the next, I make myself forget why I hated it in the first place. So I remember that I was so excited about it. I like saved up a special occasion. I lit candles. I got some wine and I was like excited and I couldn't stand it. It bothered me so much and I don't remember why.
I don't think I ever even saw it, or if I did, it made such a minor
impression
on me. I
own it. It's in my DVD collection.
I mean, I like Baxley, but I'm not that.
There's
when I found
something
that it
about
Patterson,
it, and I don't even know what it was, but it bothered me so much that I was like, just blank this from your memory bank.
Well, what's interesting is this was one of the first things. We're talking about 2002, so we're talking 16 years ago.
2001 is what they mentioned in here. So yeah,
2002 it took
is when
place
it was
supposedly
released.
Right
yeah. Mm-hmm.
But this was one of the first times you saw a lot of this meta stuff going on, where they wrote another book about this that's supposed to be the diary of one of the characters in this. Then another movie and all these other things to kind of build this whole universe around this story. And of course, now we think of the larger metaverse of Stephen King in whole different ways. The multiverse is a big thing. But at the time, this was kind of a big deal to do all these different iterations of one story.
Well, because,
and do it so well.
Before we get into the characters, there's a lot of nods. There's a nod to Carrie with the stones.
Right.
That happens twice.
So
in the beginning, part one and part three as well.
Yep. Another thing, there's the power that a couple of these guys have are very similar to powers of some of the guys from the Dark Tower. And here's my favorite little bit. At the very end of the book of Carrie, there's a little note about how they're going to go find another little girl.
Yes.
You know what her name is?
No.
Annie.
Shut the fuck up.
Yep.
Oh.
Yep. There's no other connection mentioned, but then she has a power that's virtually identical to Carrie's. Yeah.
That would be Annie.
I always think of the Rose Red thing as just on another level of the tower, but it's like Desperation or like the Bachman books. It's still part of the multiverse. It's just very distant from it, and it is mentioned someplace else as one of the thin places.
I believe that.
So it's around. It's real on the edge of these things, but at the time there was this whole thing that got built around the story, and in some ways I'm sorry he hasn't gone back to revisit it, but
I am too. It's not even mentioned in anything.
You know, it's clearly not part of the Castle Rock universe. It's peripheral, or it's related, but it's not that.
None of the characters have anything to do with anything. And
yeah,
it's
there's no strong
a whole, it's also
hook.
West Coast.
Yeah.
You know, we've got the Seattle vibe. But he does that in Storm and Century. He goes to San Francisco.
Definitely there's a larger world. And you can almost see the cues that if it's not in Maine somewhere,
it's
one
on
of
the
peripheral
Pacific.
Worlds. It's someplace else. I mean, it doesn't tend to be part of the
Pacific.
Center of the world. The worst of it is all in Maine.
Pacific Ocean has no memories. I love that. This episode of The Dark Multiverse of Stephen King is brought to you by Dr. Sleep Mattresses, the online sleep supplier that can turn your nightmares into dreamscapes. Whether you're waking from a nightmare about a phone call from your dead daughter or leaving a lovely dream of the booyah world, Dr. Sleep Mattresses are the perfect choice for a perfect night. Just hours after you order it, your Dr. Sleep Mattress will arrive in an impossibly tiny box and with a single touch explode to become one of the biggest, deepest, dreamiest mattresses you've ever slept on. But be sure to clear the room before you open it up. It happens very fast.
Dr. Sleep Incorporated, not responsible for injuries or damage incurred during mattress deployment.
And once you've wrestled that baby into submission, be prepared for the best rest ever. You'll feel like a sleeping beauty wrapped in a cocoon of comfort so complete you'll think you've been transported to another world. Look, some people suffer from insomnia. Some people sleepwalk. Some people get their throats slit by a switchblade while they're sleeping. Stuff happens. But now you can have the sleep of your life and afterlife. Better than a vampire resting on its native soil with a Dr. Sleep mattress. It's like being forced into sleep by a demon with a magic cane. Stop being the secretary of dreams and step up to or lay down on a Dr. Sleep mattress. You'll sleep so deeply, you'll want to sleep with the light on, so you always know where you are when you wake up. That's Dr. Sleep Mattresses. They open you up to the bazaar of good dreams. And thanks again to Dr. Sleep for sponsoring this episode of The Dark Multiverse of Stephen King.
The team of people, the group of people that go in there,
yes,
are each terribly interesting. Both the characters themselves and the casting. I think there's some really brilliant casting decisions here and some really questionable ones.
Really? Okay, let's start with the questionable ones.
Well, there was a certain amount of pushback on Nancy Travis as Joyce.
Really?
Which I personally thought was a great idea.
She's lovely.
Because she'd done either light comedy or a lot of...
Sly Murder and Axe Murder, I think, would qualify her
for
this.
And also, bright, perky characters. So for the bright, perky one to slowly go insane. And she is in the first
perfect.
Few scenes.
Yes.
She's very bright-eyed and very, it's like, oh, she's going to be the heroine here.
Yeah,
and
no.
And then to slowly see her be eaten by the house.
And she's the last victim of the house,
yeah.
And they really do get into her.
Of course, she's done a lot of interesting stuff in and around that. These days, she is the wife in the Tim Allen sitcom of Last Man Standing that was on ABC and is now on Fox. So she's just kind of settled into a semi-retirement role.
Mm-hmm.
She just delivers the straight lines for Tim Allen.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
But in many ways, I think this is the best thing she ever did. I just love
her So I Married an Axe Murderer. She was awesome in that. She was so good.
But that's another story.
I love it. That is another story. And we're also... It's not part of the Stephen King multiverse.
Well, far as we know.
No, not yet anyways.
So what character do you like?
Now, I've seen this miniseries, however you want to say it, I'll say movie. I've seen it probably 30 times.
Oh, my God.
Since 91.
I've seen it twice.
Or 92.
I feel so small.
Oh, really? Yeah. No, when I love something, I'll watch it over and over again. I fall asleep to it.
Yes, this is you and I being very different.
Yeah.
I rarely watch things more than once.
See,
other stuff I'll be doing only the second time since forever.
You and my husband are the same way. You both remember something perfectly, and you're like, I don't need to revisit it. There's too much other stuff to look at. Me, I'm like, this feels like home. This is comforting or is scary in a way that just, like, speaks to me. And so I'll watch it while I'm falling asleep for, like, weeks at a time and just keep going. And then when I wake up, I'm like, oh, I'll get ready for work, and I'll put on my makeup while I'm watching the rest of it. So it'll go on for, like, that forever. So I've seen this probably 30 times, but not in years. And so the fun thing for me was, is I always remember Emery. I don't know the name of the actor, but
I'm intentionally keeping this right in front of me. His name is Matt Ross.
Matt Ross.
Yeah, I think he's incredible in this.
Now, here's the thing. I always remembered hating him and thinking what a piece of shit he was, like everybody else did. But watching it this time years later, I realized, like, he's being bullied by this group. Now, yes, he doesn't bully anybody until they get to the college, which is in part two. So it's not even part one. Part two, he gets with the group. His mom embarrasses him. He's embarrassed. He walks up to the group and says, okay, we're going to Rose Red. And then the little girl who's autistic, Annie, she makes the bike wheel start and stop. And he tries talking to her and he goes, what is she, retarded? And that's him bullying another person that's smaller and weaker than him because he's been bullied already by the group several times and for no reason. So when it came out in like 92, I remember thinking Emery was this fucking piece of shit. And he was such a douche and he was so mean to everybody. But what I realized is when I'm watching it this time, he's taking care of his mother, who's bullying him and overspending, mm-hmm. and he has no money. And he's doing this for his mother, even though he knows that it's dangerous for himself because he's already getting warnings from it. And then, yes, he does pick on the little girl, which pissed me off. And then later he becomes a douche again. But, you know, he's a sarcastic person, but, you know, he's a bullied person.
He's a bullied person. Who then turns around and bullies others when he has the opportunity. Mm-hmm. The acting job by this guy, by Matt, is amazing
to
me.
It's great.
It is
His
so
facial
convincing.
Expressions,
and
too.
I don't know if
good.
You recognize him from anything else.
No.
He was a regular on Big Love for a few years. And
no way.
My favorite is he plays the super sophisticated, ultra-millennial asshole boss on Silicon Valley.
I never watched
that,
but...
He owns the big company that's the fake version of Google. He's skinny. He's beautiful. Ah. You should look at a picture of him now.
Ooh,
he's very handsome.
He's very handsome.
In his middle age. And
look at those cheekbones.
I know. And here he's just this fat schlub of a guy. I think he did a hell of a job.
He did a wonderful
job. He's one of my favorite characters in this thing.
And,
because he's so different than what you expect.
And you know what I hated? Is I love Julian Sands. He's like masturbation material. Like, I think he is so delicious. You know,
just
Warlock,
everything?
I remember as a little kid, but basically everything that I've ever seen him in, there's just some...
He's always the same. He's one of those actors who's just one character.
Like Denzel Washington,
movies.
He's
he's good in them.
But
in this one, absolutely.
They're both hot. They can both play the same character as much as they want to, and I'm fine with it.
Like Jimmy
I'm cool.
Stewart
yeah.
used and to, or Cary Grant. They never changed. They would just find movies to stick them in. That's like
or Will Ferrell. I don't mind
exactly.
that either.
Yeah.
I always thought Julian Sands since I was a little girl, and especially Boxing Helena. I think he's very sexy. There's something just fucked up and sexy about him. And he actually picks on Emery a lot in this movie. And in the beginning, the first part especially, he only gives like one-liners.
Mm-hmm.
So he doesn't know how to deliver a one-liner because he's Julian fucking Sands. He's fucking awesome. He's fucking masturbation material for all women all across America that were from the 90s and 80s and probably earlier than I remember. But anyways... He's so good, but he doesn't do one-liners well. So in part two, when he starts actually having conversations with people, he gets back to Julian Sands' hotness. But he's one of the first people that picks on Emery. And I find that very strange because I know that in like movie 2002, bullying, and there was no cyberbullying and things like that like there is now. But he was one of the first people who's the nice guy, but that picks on Emery before Emery even has any reason for everybody.
I thought it was because... Julian's character, he's like the worst version of himself. They're basically the same guy. They're both psychics, mind reader types. And I think he dislikes it because there, but for the grace of God, go I. That's what I could have been. He scares me because he's the shitty version of me.
You're right, so because at the end they do pull together.
Mm-hmm.
They become the same team.
They are like two sides of the same coin.
Yes.
You can become one kind of guy or the other kind of guy.
Okay, I can totally see that. I love that.
But Judith Ivey, who plays the Kathy Kramer. Now, I'd never seen her do anything but comedy before that.
Wait, which one?
She's
Ellen?
The old southern woman with the bad haircut.
Okay, gotcha. Mm-hmm.
I think she's totally wasted in this movie. I mean, I think the casting is interesting. She's very convincing, and she went on from there to do a lot more dramatic stuff as well as comedy.
I don't know her from anything else, but her face is always familiar.
Yeah, she's a well-known character actress forever. Still, almost all these people are still working. With one exception, all these folks are still out there.
Which is the
kicking.
One?
Matt Caselor, I think his name is, that plays Steve Rimbauer.
Oh.
He retired from acting shortly after he made this and hasn't done anything since.
Really? He's a really handsome guy.
He had two or three roles in which he played gay characters, even though apparently he is not.
But if he
could
do that, that's amazing.
I don't know if he got tired of it or bored with it, but he moved up to the Pacific Northwest and he's not acting anymore.
Oh.
Virtually everybody else in this thing that's still alive is still working.
I was just going to ask, is Vic still alive?
Yeah, Vic is actually Kevin Teig, who, interesting guy, his big break, he was young and handsome, and he was on Emergency, which was one of the first EMT things, like back at Adam 12,
right.
That thing, he was the other one. And then after that, he didn't see much of him here and there for about a decade. And then when he came back as this gray-haired, older, beefy guy.
Right.
And he continues to work till this day. Because
he looks familiar, but
you've seen him. He's old. He's in his early 70s now. But he's still in there working. He's still doing
good
shit all the time. And virtually everyone, again, that's still alive.
What about the little girl? Whatever happened to her?
The little girl ended up doing a few years in The Guiding Light. Actually, before this, she did the Halloween Town movies, which was kind of strange. They're like light Disney-type TV movies about a haunted town, and she's their comedies. She did three of those, and then she takes the dark version of this But and she's still around, still doing stuff, hasn't had a big breakout, but she's a working, absolutely a working actress. The saddest story is David Dukes, who plays the, or Duke.
No, it's David Dukes with an S, because I remember when we were watching it last night, I said, oh, thank God for that S. Yeah. Because Jesus God in heaven, that's a terrible name otherwise.
Well, and he actually died while this was being made.
No way.
Yeah, this was his
last
movie.
It said in memory or something like that.
Yeah, that's what it says in memory of David Dukes at the very end. He died just before he shot the last scene. Ironically, the last scene he was supposed to shoot was his death scene.
His own death scene?
In this. So when they did it, they used a stand-in, and King rewrote a few of the scenes that he was supposed to do, wrote for other
characters. Is he a character in this?
Yeah, he's the mean college professor that hates Nancy Travis.
No.
Him.
Yeah. I didn't know that was him.
That's David Dukes, and he's
blew my fucking passed away. Mind.
He's did a lot of really nice work in the years he was acting. The one I remember best is he played one of the first serial killers on film in The First Deadly Sin. Bad movie otherwise, Dukes was great. Frank Sinatra movie, believe it or not. But he was really excellent. But he passed away while this was being made, playing tennis. They had a heart attack, dropped dead. But all the rest of these people, and obviously
I feel
Emily
bad
Deschanel,
that he went running through on part three. Running through the friggin' weeping willows and everything, and was like totally screaming and everything. I wonder if that contributed to his heart attack.
Apparently, it was just one of the aneurysm things. He was hale and hearty and seemed fine, and then
that
playing
sucks.
Tennis and died.
I didn't know that. That bums me out.
Well, and then of course Emily Deschanel here, who went on to 18 years of being Bones.
Who?
The pretty blonde here.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, she's Emily Deschanel.
Because I don't watch TV shows unless, like, you know, it's.
Yeah,
certain ones I'm super into.
How many thousands of years of Bones adjust?
My friends always say that I would like that. Do you think so?
The first couple seasons, you would like a lot. It got very, to my mind, it got very repetitive. It's a show about a medical examiner at a big museum who gets involved in an FBI case and then ultimately becomes a consultant for a good-looking FBI agent.
Okay.
Played by the guy who was Angel on Buffy.
No.
And it was successful. I think it was on 11 years, and just ended. And then, of course, the last one, the one
can
we
talk about
here.
Ellen fucking Rimbauer, please.
Yeah, we're looking at her right now.
Oh, she's so gorgeous.
She looks so modern to me. She doesn't look 19th century to me.
Really?
The actress who plays
but
her, who's
she's not had like facial reconstruction or anything.
No, it's
just
that Julia
beautiful.
Campbell, who's the actress, was in a ton of things, commercials and TV shows
I've
and stuff.
I've seen stuff, but I can't place one.
But she's so, to me, so 90s pretty. That she doesn't look 1890s pretty. I wanted someone with higher cheekbones and, you know, that looks like something.
Skinnier, a little more gaunt or something.
Yeah, or just more.
Or more voluptuous.
She just looks very modern to me. She doesn't feel like an old person.
I get lost in her eyes. She's so gorgeous.
She is absolutely beautiful. Still working, though not as much anymore.
What does she do?
Last thing she did, she played Patsy Ramsey in Who Killed
Chuck. That's what it was. Yeah. I knew she looked familiar for something.
And that was only a couple of years ago.
But what was she before that? Wasn't she something really pretty?
Tons of things. She's been in just about
everything. I mean, Patsy Ramsey, I don't think sex, but I'll tell you what, like, this chick is sexy in this.
She was in
the
Craigslist Killer. She's done episodes of tons of shows, CSI and Lie to Me and Dexter. And she was
Dexter.
Actually in five episodes of Dexter.
Okay, that's what I know her from.
Yeah, but she's been around a long time, and she's very good. But I didn't believe her as a 1800s beauty. She just never convinced me. No, to me, the real interesting story in all this is
gorgeous and evil. I love it.
Her transformation into the evil one didn't really convince me.
Okay, so here's the thing. Her and her friend, companion, who she befriended in Africa when she was ill and came back with her to America.
Yeah, the slave who became their slave.
Yes. Yeah. Well, they call it a slave, and then everybody makes sure to say it's the companion because they were friends. And she considered her a sister. I mean, she even killed her own husband. With Sakina. She used Sakina to seduce the husband so they could push him out the fucking rose red window. Sakina, what actress is that?
Well, interesting. She did very little before or after. She was basically cast for this role.
Oh, she's great.
She's perfect for it, I think, but she's not well known.
I love her friendship with her friend that's a Gensel man, and I really like it. And I think that they're both so beautiful in their own way. Like, I like the big, huge eyes of Sakina. It's always like I see everything. And,
that's perfect casting. She's kind of spooky.
She is.
She
has
exactly the opposite to me.
Very polite.
From the first look, you're going, okay, spooky, weird.
Because her
first
eyes are so
look
open.
At her friend, rich one, nothing. Yeah. But no, for me, the big thing is Melanie Lynskey, who's in this.
Yes. Okay.
She's become one of my favorite actresses. The first thing I saw her in is the first thing she did. You know, she's New Zealander. She's a New Zealand actress.
Is she?
Her original deal was Heavenly Creatures.
With Kate Winslet.
Yeah.
That was such a good movie.
That's an amazing movie. That's the first thing she did.
I'm about then the same age that either she was or she was supposed to be playing in that movie, because I remember the same feeling of, like, I want to kill my parents. And so, you know, they did that, and I was like, wow, this is a movie that I understand.
What year were you born?
76.
She was born in 77.
Ah!
Yeah, so you guys are the same age.
Yes, we are.
Way younger than
and, me. Yes, and Kate Winslet's probably about the same age, too.
I expect.
And so, yeah, I remember just having that teenage angst of, like, I want to kill my parents. Like, this is totally fucked up, and the world sucks. And
but that means she's 41 now, and she looks exactly the same now.
Yeah.
Or not exactly, near
what
she looks like 18 years ago.
She actually looks better now than she did then, because you know how women, when we're younger, our faces are more poofy.
Mm-hmm.
And then especially women who have one baby, oh my God, their face slims down. You can see the cheekbones and everything. So in this, she's got that Drew Barrymore pudgy face of the 90s, kind of like.
And some Drew Barrymore mannerisms. She's kind of going for the Drew Barrymore.
She really is. It's like
the middle
very
Drew
soft
Barrymore.
Talking.
Not the kid Drew Barrymore and not the Charlie's Angels Drew
and
Barrymore.
Not, yes, exactly.
Yeah, the middle.
But she has a lot of mannerisms, a lot of speech patterns that Drew does. And
the 100 First Dates Drew Barrymore.
50 First Dates. Yes.
The sequel.
Oh, whatever. It was all, the sequel was 100 First Dates. It starred so many people. We can't even remember them all.
No,
her in Castle Rock is brilliant.
Well, and I only went back and watched this again because of Castle Rock, and I went back, she was in, because I barely remember Rose Red at that point. I went back and watched it and really enjoyed it. What's amazing is almost all of these rooms in this are real rooms in a mansion in Salem that they found.
No,
they're not perfect. I mean, they dress them and change them, but really, these are real. This is
a
real place.
I want to go there.
And that's one of the reasons I like it, is that it doesn't look like sets. It doesn't look like they made a haunted house. Another small thing in watching this that I really like is the fact that Annie and Melanie Lynskey's characters actually look like sisters. Again, I think Baxley did a great job as director. I think the production design that could have been so over the top and melodramatic is really pretty reined in.
It's subtle and lovely.
Yeah, and lovely. And you're right, this house is one you want to visit and see all the time. Well, then there was one other character we didn't get to that's not part of the team, but that you love, the creepy-ass reporter who gets his early on.
Bollinger. Yeah. We got Jimmy Simpson. And I love him as the McPoyle brother, the main one in It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. I had forgotten that he was in this. I just see him as McPoyle. Anything that he's in, I'm like, oh my God, McPoyle. Now.
Yeah, that was kind of my reaction to this whole thing when I went back and watched it recently is, oh my God, she's in this. He's in this. Yeah. All these people that I recognize from a million other things.
Totally.
And, they did this too. And
yeah.
Not only does it hold up well with time, frequently you see these movies and half these actors were never seen again.
Right.
And in this case,
all of
much,
them except for the Grimbauer son.
Yeah, and the ones that died are still in there working and have done some very good work. And then, of course, Lynskey's completely killing it.
She is killing it. Her and Castle Rock. Oh.
I just so hope, now that we've seen, and we have to talk about Castle Rock.
And we will.
Program,
now that we've,
but I just hope that she's back for the next season.
She has to be because she's the heart of Castle Rock.
As far as I'm concerned, she is the current
she
Castle
She really
Rock.
Is, yeah. Yes.
So we'll see.
Oh, yeah, the current one, obviously, not the disincorporated.
And in general, when King was doing this is when he came to the realization, he writes, that miniseries were really the best ways to tell
tell his story, yeah.
Yeah, and I think we've seen that. Again, when the short stories are made into movies, they're really good. With rare exceptions, most recently Gerald's Game, most of the books,
surprisingly,
you
good.
Have to peel out a lot of what the novel has to make even a good movie.
Mm-hmm.
But you take one of his novellas or one of his short stories, they can make a movie. You're going to go any bigger, go to the miniseries. Again, I don't think there's a single thing done by Stephen King I haven't seen. But most of them I saw the year they came out or the year they were published. And few of them have I gone back and seen since. So this is like a rediscovery. I mean, sometimes the things I'm seeing is, that's not nearly as good as I remember. And other times it's this is way better than I remember.
I think this is one of the way better than...
This is as good as I remember. This one hasn't suffered at all.
No, it's not suffered. And like I said, I'd seen it so many times when it first came out. I would fall asleep to it constantly. I really, really loved it. The side stories in Rose Red are another thing that I love about haunted houses. this, where they take the time out to show us little glimpses of real people that end up being dead, whether or not we see how they die or disappear, what mm-hmm. became of them afterwards, I love. This is what makes haunted houses so exciting to me, is the stories behind it, the history of them. All the people that die or disappear, we get at least a glimpse of their story. And I love that about Stephen King. And that's something that I love about haunted house things. So
it's true. Even in his short stories or his novellas, people don't appear without context. You really just see, here's the guy.
Yeah.
And he's being eaten by rats, or he's being killed mm-hmm. by whatever or whatever. You almost always get backstory. I found 1922 to be a great example of that.
Yes.
And then it's just a basic revenge story. But you end up learning so much about this guy and about his wife and about the whole...
The characters surrounding them, the daughter and the so daughter-in-law.
That's one of the reasons they're so satisfying. Mm-hmm. Even the simplest stories that beg to be a linear... We've talked about it before, like Cujo. Suddenly, all of the stuff that surrounds it is just as interesting as the central
horrific story.
And of course, haunted house stories like this are made for that. They're nothing but history and context. Mm-hmm. This was actually one of the criticisms of this, is that there was too much of that stuff that it got in the way of telling the story of the seven people in the house.
Not having
it. I think it's more convoluted than it needs to be. I think there's a more explanation required than is usual for King.
Okay, like because they're vampires at the end, let's talk about the ending. So they are still alive, her and Sakina, and they're like vampires, but they're... I'm imagining that they're trying to say that their emotional vampires are sucking off the life of these psychic people and to make the house keep rebuilding and to make themselves more youthful, although we don't see necessarily any evidence of that physically from what we see of them. However, they are still alive. But at the end, when she gets blasted down to the ground, some light comes out of her. And then at the end, it's Nancy Travis, Dr. Joyce, and Sakina and Ellen all... as glowing light in the top rose red tower.
Yeah,
standing on the balcony
or whatever there. Yeah, I remember that. I think it's too complicated.
Were they vampires or were they ghosts? Or are they haunting or are they just entity? Why were they all still there? And why is the house?
I
could think they could have ended when Dr. Joyce gets all blown up and attacked by everybody.
Yeah, I agree. And also, was it her, the Rimbauer character, was the one that made the house haunted? Was she the center of it, or was it the house itself that sucked her in?
It never really covers it, because the ground, before the house was even constructed, that guy got decapitated. There was the guy that choked on the apple. There was the guy that got shot up by a teamster.
So who corrupted who is basically it. I mean, if you
We don't have an Indian burial ground like we do in Pet Cemetery, where it's like, okay,
you go back to good old Amityville, and it's been cursed earth since the beginning, and everybody gets seduced or corrupted by it, including the Lutzes.
So maybe because they have psychics in this, it's one feeding off of the other. It's Ellen Rimbauer feeding off of the sour ground, and the sour ground feeding off of Ellen Rimbauer and her hatred for men. And it happens to like blood. So, okay, cool. We'll kidnap the women and we'll kill the men. And we both feed off of each other. Maybe that's it.
And I wish if he'd stuck just with that. But that'd I also see, when he cobbled all this together, The Haunting of Hill House, Shirley Jackson's book, it's the house. The house makes people crazy.
Well, he loves Shirley Jackson. But I mean, legend, who doesn't? But
the legend
loves
of Hill House, the other one, it's a guy. I think there's a little too much, more than a little too much plot, particularly in part three of this thing. I think the chemistry between these seven characters more than makes up for
it. Yeah, it's fun.
I kind of feel like this is one of the, I want to say B grade, one of the King books that if you just want to sit down, if it's a stormy weekend and you got nothing to do, and read this straight through, read a book like Christine. Okay, Christine.
I had my gloves on me, sir. I would slap you across the face.
I liked it just fine. I think it's a minor work. That's what I'm looking
okay,
for.
Okay, on a rainy day, watch Rose Red. Otherwise, let me know, because I will take my gloves off and I will slap Brad across the face, and we'll have a duel tomorrow at noon. And it doesn't matter what day you listen to this. You could listen to it a year from now.
And we'll still have the
we'll have a duel. Just send us an email.
I'll be dueling continuously for the next couple of years.
You sure will.
God. I think the third part is the weakest one in terms of logic.
I think graphically it's great,
and I think it's a very satisfying ending. Look, whenever, as we've talked about many times, Stephen King's not great at endings. His best endings is when something blows up or catches fire. So like the ending of Salem's Lot, the town burns down. Carrie, the town burns down. The Shining, the hotel blows up.
For sure.
And here too, the house blows up. There are others where
if
he doesn't.
I don't
doesn't,
know how to end something, I'm blowing it
I'm
all
blowing
up.
Blowing it up.
And that works. I'm fine with that.
And he even builds to that point. The only two options here are for the people to either die or escape and the house to go on forever. Or to blow it up.
You know, there was a part in this that really annoyed me. I'll have to say now that we're talking about this. Emery, who gets meaner as it goes on, but for the first part, I remember just thinking, oh my God, this is just a bullied person, and I feel terrible that I judged him so harshly back in 2001, and the years following that I watched it. But he does get his fingers chopped off in the door, and the little girl is responsible for letting Rose Red use her to close all the doors and all the windows of everything and make everything escapable proof.
I like escapable proof.
Escapable proof. Yeah. Thank you. I'm like, that's a word now. Okay, we're putting
it. We just did it.
So his fingers come off, and he's the only one that he starts off saying, do you have any nail polish in your purse, to the sister, Sissy? So we can have her breathe it and knock her out so that we can get out. And they're like, that's evil. And then later he's like wanting to bash her over the head with a billiard ball.
Yeah, he's always advocating killing her.
He wanted her to just, he goes, why don't you just bend over and breathe really hard and blow on your thumbs and you'll pass out and then we can get out. So first he comes up with actually very innocent ways that me and my friends, before we even knew drugs were a thing, were like, oh my God, you can totally pass out and get high on this. And it was like things like that, where you bend over and you blow really hard and then you take in a breath and then you just knock over. So he came up with nice reasons. And then after a while, I mean, your four fingers are gone. Nobody cares about you because they've all been bullying you this entire time. I mean, they really have been, and it gets worse and worse, and then his ugliness comes out more and more. And so then he's in pain. I probably would have killed the little bitch, too.
Yep.
I probably would have knocked that little kid over. I would have been like, look, you didn't listen to me when I said, let's just get her something and knock her the fuck out. Now I'm going to kill her.
And now it's too late. Yeah. No, I agree. And I think the characters, they're not just stereotype pieces on a chessboard we move around, kill this guy, kill that guy.
Right.
Like, you know, in so many haunted house movies, it's five, seven, eight, almost interchangeable people. Slaughter, 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 the end. Or, you know, one guy emerges, the final girl emerges at the end. Like House of Wax and 8 million others like it. These are real people who actually change over the course of this and for the most part deserve what they get. It's understandable even if it's not deserved.
Agreed.
And I like that. I like that as usual.
I do too.
Deeper and richer.
So if you want to throw logic to the wind, start drinking, watch part one.
That's true.
Get drunk by part two, and then you can enjoy
part three
because it's just fun as fuck.
Yeah, it is fun. Yeah, don't push too hard at this one.
No.
It's like logic-wise, it's not one of the strongest.
Sit back, a lot of pants off.
And beautifully made, and we can always hope that Craig Baxley will come back and direct something else.
That'd be nice. But
anyway, that was great. Okay, that was a little longer than we usually go here. But this was, after all, it was a three-part miniseries.
Yes,
it was like
it
six
really
hours.
Was.
So we went a little long. We apologize for that. But we also wanted to speak to you here from the future about some breaking news in the Stephen King world, that we should play a bad news sting. I'm saving those for an ad. Stephen King just tweeted, in fact, that he has a new novella coming out on October 30th of 2018 called Elevation. And it's set in Castle Rock. It sounds a little bit like Thinner and a little bit like some other things.
I am so excited,
And it sounds really interesting, but we wanted to encourage you all to go out and get it. It'll be available in ebook form and in print and an audio version on October 30. And we're going to take a week or two to read it ourselves. And then it's going to be one of our major topics on Thanksgiving week.
Exactly. Right? So please join us. I mean, you know, it comes out, don't forget, the day before my anniversary. So you can all remember my anniversary. It's Halloween. So
I didn't know that.
Oh, you didn't know that?
No, I don't think I knew that.
Oh, yeah. I said I'd never get married, but if I ever did, I want to get married on my favorite holiday, which is Halloween.
Perfect.
So, yes. Remind yourself of my anniversary by buying the Stephen King audiobook, regular book, however you want it, and then join us for the talk on Thanksgiving.
Yeah, it's called Elevation, and it's available for pre-order on Amazon right now. So, just wanted to let you know that, and we'll be back next week with a whole new who the hell knows what. Check Instagram and Twitter at Dark Multipod and both to see what it is we'll be talking about next.
Absolutely.
Okay, let's do the skeleton keys for episode 4, which is called The Box. Isn't a lot, but there are a couple of pretty big ones that I think are worth mentioning. Molly Bloom, that wonderful scene where she's got the prospective homebuyers in Warden Lacey's house.
That was hilarious. I loved it.
And so much is in the background. We now know that the wife has already left town, never to return. And
oh, is that right? I wasn't.
Yeah, well, that
I
was
mean,
the postcard. It said greetings from Florida, wherever it was. Oh. That's what she did. She sent a postcard saying, yeah, I'm gone. I'm out. You can sell the house. She's
gotcha. Oh, I read that quickly as a sympathy card just from somebody from
Florida. I think
Florida.
It was implied.
Oh, okay.
That's why we never see her again, is that she's completely done with the place. Not to mention the more of his paintings on the
mm-hmm.
wall. That,
I want to know what all that's about. We'll get
yeah,
there,
that,
sure.
that kind of that builds as we go here. Mm-hmm. But she does say,
if those paintings start changing, I'm going to just start stabbing you. Okay.
As far as I know, that one. But she does mention when they discover that that's Warden Lacey who's committed suicide. She says, what was it? A serial strangler died in my house. And that has to be Frank Dodd from the Dead Zone.
Yes.
Which also means that Frank Dodd lived across the street from Henry Deaver.
Which is crazy because
what's going on in that neighborhood?
And also, what about the bathtub thing? So
yeah, there was early on, in, I think it was episode one, actually, where
I think so too.
Warden Lacey's doing the voiceover.
Yes.
Terry O'Quinn's doing the
mm-hmm.
voiceover about all the horrible things that happened. And there's one tracking shot going through a living room and into a bathroom where there's somebody dead in the bathtub with blood everywhere.
Yes.
Pretty sure that's Frank Dodd because
yeah.
that's what he did. He killed himself
so.
In his house after...
And
been discovered.
Lead drops all over the floor. So yeah, I think that's
yeah.
what
so I think certainly there's a strong connection that we already know between Dead Zone and what's going on here.
So basically, he killed himself at the end of the book, and he lived across the street from Henry Deaver.
Yeah.
Which I mean, I wonder if the dad had any connection with that. Just saying, the dad
well,
was
that
an asshole.
Neighborhood
we
particularly
have...
bad. Is this yeah. influence of whatever's going on here strong? Right around
has affected this
there.
Girl, and also yeah. we know that the preacher's not the nice guy that he says that he is. And
right.
Frank
and
Dodd,
the kid himself, has got something going on. And
yeah.
then before that, it was Frank Dodd's neighborhood. So,
let me try this now. All right, this guy's name is Joseph
Desjardins.
Joseph Desjardins is the brother of Vince Desjardins.
okay.
Who was a member of Ace Merrill's gang in The Body. Joseph tells the story about how Vince's insurance fraud was why he got a felony. Vince never lived in the house. He moved south when his sentence was commuted. Joseph was a suspect in Henry's kidnapping, but that crate in the back wasn't his cage.
Didn't look right.
No, it wasn't the cage. And he also says, I never touched you. Ambiguous, but apparently he's not the guy. I mean, I don't think it was a sexual thing the way he said that. So, you know.
No, I mean, like, I never laid a hand on you. I had nothing to do. I'd never seen you before.
Yeah, I've never seen you before. I never touched you.
Yeah, but this does give us a fairly complete history of Vince Desjardins from The Body
yes.
forward. Because he got in trouble there. Then, you know, he ended up being a completely no-account guy, lazy.
Mm-hmm.
Years later, cut off his thumb and one of his fingers so he could get a insurance claim, got caught, went to Shawshank, got out again.
And then he kept his brother's finger and thumb, and then
yeah.
he got in trouble and questioned by the police about Henry Deaver because they were like, he's like, what's the problem with having a finger and a thumb in a jar?
Yeah,
like, I don't get it. It's in my family. It's mine.
And we know now that Vince died someplace else.
Well, the interesting thing to me is that the Desjardins...
French for the gardens.
Okay,
yes.
You know what?
Yes.
Vince the Gardens. Okay. Who is in the gang in The Body. Their favorite game with Ace Merrill was taking baseball bats and smashing mailboxes.
Yep.
And the mailbox that it's there, it's like hanging, like the post is in front and the mailbox is under, so it would be like a much harder hit. I wonder if you get 10 points for that or 20. I don't
know.
Or
at least 20.
Yeah.
Yeah. And of course it does, that whole house does leave one of the great mysteries unsolved as far as we know. Which
yeah.
is, how did he get that piano onto the second floor, and when it fell through the floor, he didn't do anything about
didn't
it?
Didn't do anything about it. And also, like, did he sell off all the things in the house? Because there's nothing that seems of value in that house.
No, just stuff that he hoarded and added
in. Get rid
yeah.
of the... No, maybe he doesn't want anyone in there. But I would think, if all the haircuts, quote-unquote, that he's doing, he would have had someone buy that piano off of him. But just leaving it there is so interesting
so
and
strange.
Weird.
So
I love
strange.
It.
Oh, I was going to mention one other thing. It's another meta thing, but the actor who plays Joseph Desjardins, not ever been in any other King stuff that we can
find. How do
you
always say his last name right? I hate you.
But but that actor, if you are as old as I am and remember Dark Shadows, when it was a daily supernatural soap opera
yeah.
on TV, he was one of the major vampires in the show.
I love it. So even though he wasn't a Stephen King
actor anywhere,
yeah.
but he was a modern day vampire on a show that was
That's
clearly
badass.
Inspired by the uptake and interest in the supernatural and horror way back when.
I like that.
Yeah, interesting. Well, that's it for this week's for episode four. And we'll be back next week with Dark Multiverse tie-ins for episode five.
We like all of our... I'm excited. I like all my Easter eggs. All in one basket.
And that's it for Rose Red. There's a bit more, including links to the various spin-offs and even Stephen R. Baxley's underappreciated miniseries Triangle over on Shudder at the moment, in our wonderful show notes at www.darkmultipod.com. And as always, please join us on Twitter, where we're known as @darkmultipod, or on Instagram, where we're also known as @darkmultipod. Or you can also drop us a note directly to darkmultipod@gmail.com, or leave us a message to the website. It all ends up at the same old place anyway. We also announce what we're going to be talking about in the next episode over on Twitter and Instagram, along with lots of other horror and King news. So, go, go, go. Once again, our beautiful and haunting theme and bed music is used by the generous permission of Chrysanthi Tan, a brilliant musician, composer, and performer. Visit her website at chrysanthitan.com. It's spelled just like chrysanthemum without the mum at the end. Just Google it. Give it your best guess. You'll get there. We also have a picture of Chrysanthi and a link to her website and her Patreon account over on the website. She's terrific and truly deserves your support. As for Kat and me, well, I'm easy. Ask anybody. I'm totally Googleable, if that's a word, and it is now. And most of my books are for sale over on Amazon.com. Kat, meanwhile, don't go looking. Trust me. That's a deep, dark rabbit hole from which no one has returned unchanged. And though we may all feel vaguely uncomfortable when asking, it really does help to get the word out if you go on over to iTunes to like us, rate us, and review us. But just as important, mention how totally wonderful you are in all of your own social media. And even to your flesh and blood human friends and family and acquaintances. We're not proud. We'll take whatever we can get. And after all is said and done, we'll be back next week with another huge, scary show. So we'll see you then.
Excuse me. Nice. Thank you. Where's light? Bubbles.